Good afternoon, everybody. I'm presenting prevalence of herpes simplex virus type 2 and associated risk factors among females in the United States using National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey between 2009 and 2012. Let's talk about herpes a little bit more in general and see who gets herpes and what's the cause of herpes. Most people get herpes simplex virus 1 as an infant and child. This virus can be spread by skin to skin contact with who carries the viruses. A person usually gets herpes simplex virus 2 through sexual contact. And about 16% of sexually active adults in the United States carry herpes simplex virus 2. Herpes simplex virus spread from person to person. You can get a virus from touching a herpes sores, and most of people, however, get herpes simplex from an infected person who does not have sores. Physicians call this asymptomatic viral shedding. So, in introduction, we have herpes simplex virus 2 is one of the most prevalent sexually transmitted infections in the US. There is an estimate that about 800,000 people in the United States get new herpes infection annually. Nationwide, 15.5% of persons aged 14 to 49 years have herpes simplex virus 2 infection and is more prevalent in women compared to men. However, little is known about its associated risk factor among U.S. females. Here we have our research questions. What is prevalence of herpes simplex virus 2 infection among U.S. females, and what are herpes simplex virus 2 associated risk factors among this population? Usually, there is no sign, but when present, the symptom and sign of genital herpes include pain or itching. That begins within 2 to 10 days after exposure to an infected sexual partner. A small red bumps or tiny white blister, which may appear several days later. Ulcers, that is from ruptured blisters, and finally scabs that forms as the ulcer heals. In methodology, survey and lab data from 2009 to 2012, U.S. enhanced data were combined for female age 20 to 49 years old. Enhanced is a survey designed to assess the health and nutritional status of adults and children in the United States. The survey is unique in that it combined interviews and physical examinations. Data were weighted to reflect the enhanced complex survey design. Descriptive statistics, binary and multiple logistic regression were done using SAS 9.3 PROC survey procedure. As you see, this graph is presenting herpes simplex virus 2 infection prevalence by socio-demographic characteristics, 2009 to 2012 enhanced data. Based on race, herpes simplex virus 2 is more prevalent in non-Hispanic African American. Also, this infection is also more common among people who has high school education levels. And we also see here two upward and downward trends for age and income. For age, people get more infected as they get older. And for income, it's more common among those with less annual income. The prevalence is higher in unmarried, that include single, divorce, and never married. The overall herpes simplex virus 2 prevalence among female aged 20 to 49 years old was 23.6%. In summary, prevalence of herpes simplex virus 2 was higher in African American, in those aged more than 39 years old, in unmarried adults, those with less than high school education, those with less than $20,000 annual income. As you see in this graph, in addition, we have 99.2% of those women had vaginal sex. Also, 87.6% oral sex, 48.3% anal sex, 12.2% sex with other women, and 51.1% never use condom. After controlling for confounders in multiple regression, women who had less education, less annual income, anal sex, and those were unmarried, African-American, and age 40 to 49 years old were more likely to have herpes simplex virus 2 infection. Using condom and having sex with women had no significant relationship with herpes simplex virus 2 infection. You see in this graph, in this table, people with higher school education are 1.9 times more likely to be infected versus those with more than higher school education. We use more than high school education as a reference group here. Also, in age group, people who are between 14 to 49 are 5.2 times more likely to be infected than the reference group, as people are between 20 and 29 years old. In marital status, you can see is 1.4 times more in unmarried. And in income group, people who are who earn less than $20,000 per year are 1.7 more likely to be infected than the reference group who earn more than $65,000 annually. For race, black are 5.7 times more likely to get infected than the reference group who are white. I'm talking about white people. And for anal sex group, having anal sex with non-anal sex, people with anal sex are 1.6 times more likely to get infected than the other group. In conclusion, herpes simplex virus infection is common among U.S. females and associated with low education, low income, older age, and having anal sex, being African-American and unmarried. Findings from this study suggest the need for prevention among at-risk population. Healthcare providers should be aware of socio-demographic disparity and its potential implication in order to deliver better care for patients with herpes simplex virus 2 infections. We have some limitations regarding to enhanced data. Enhanced data provide only cross-sectional and periodic data, which are not suitable for studying causal relationships. Also, enhanced data are based on self-report information that cause bias and recall errors. Here's my reference, and thank you.
So now I'd like to open up for questions, please. And when you ask a question, I will repeat it so that everyone can hear, and also so that the recording captures it. Yes, please.
Thank you all for those great talks. This is a question for Ben, and I'm intrigued by what you might find if you were to look at the differences between the groups of folks who use the EEG more than once for treatment of their sexually transmitted infections. And I'm wondering if you might be able to look at partner treatment. I don't know if there is a state that you would have cited partner therapy.
So one of the physician collaborators that work with me is here with me today in the audience, so I might defer the latter half of that question to her. The question is characterizing the super user population, and I'm sorry, can you repeat the first part that you were interested in? Yeah, I think, again, one of the things that we haven't looked at yet is their actual medical usage pattern overall, and how does that compare to their STI usage pattern. So, you know, they may have come to the ED three times in the two-year time period for an STI-related diagnosis, but a total of 20 times that were other, you know, for other reasons, or they may have only come three times. And so that's something that we want to look at to characterize their usage pattern. And in terms of the partner status, I'm going to defer to Dr. Drettler, who can speak a little bit more about that.
So we do have expedited partner therapy. I don't think the ER is doing it. So I think that's part of the whole idea that this should be more through STI clinics, because there is not a set protocol in our emergency department. So while I think it's allowed in the state, I do not think it's happening in practice, especially in the emergency department. And I think that's something when we get to the qualitative interviews, we'd like to know more, because it's actually not recorded in our medical record system at all, whether there was any real discussion of partner therapy and follow-up. And so those are other things that we want to look into in general, is what are people being told when these tests are done and when they're being empirically treated, and is there any follow-up, and is there any discussion of your partner should be treated as well, and some safe sex practices and all that stuff that's not really being recorded in our medical record at this time. So what it is right now there's no city, so that's why we made the designation of the city versus the county. So there is a county STD clinic, but it is not centrally located, and it is not in the same area as a lot of the population, as you can see on the maps that Ben showed. And so the clinic, the city STI clinic closed in November 2013, so now there are for-profit urgent care centers where you can go for your STI care instead, but there's no dedicated STI clinic for the city of St. Louis anymore. And that was the impetus for the study, exactly. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, please. Will you repeat the question?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Good.
So the question is whether we looked at
HIV infection and possible increased risk in women who are infected rectally with chlamydia and gonorrhea. We did look at the proportion of HIV infections, but it was actually very low, so it really would have precluded any analysis. Well, so everybody who is, so the question is about whether there are, whether we included any behavioral correlates to look at the risk of extragenital infection. We are going to expand the analysis and look at some behavioral correlates, but everybody who was included in the study did report sexual exposures at the oropharynx or the rectum. But as far as demographic correlates and things like that, we are going to expand on this and look at some risks of extragenital infection.
And were you asking a question about herpes simplex, the last presentation?
Well, he had the breakdown of the oral anal was quite high, and that may be relative to others, and the odds ratio was rather high.
Great. Thank you. Other questions, please?
The question is whether we missed people who may have been treated but not infected, is that, or whether we folks weren't treated even though they were infected. Did I understand you correctly?
Right. You're looking at, you said that you missed or would have missed this many people
who were infected.
Not doing the COVID testing.
Mm-hmm.
How many people would have been treated?
Oh, treated. Right. I personally, for the focus of this, I don't have that information. It's possible that we could look at it, though.
Other questions or comments? Yes, please.
I just wanted to point out the fact that the chlamydia gonorrhea assessment that's mainly performed right now is nucleic acid.
Right, so I will try to summarize that for purposes of the record. And the first comment spoke to the fact that the NAT test may be fine at diagnosing the existence of chlamydia or gonorrhea, but doesn't get at the question of whether there's resistance with that particular strain. And unfortunately, the test that will get us that information, which is important information, is more invasive than the NAT. And so I guess you're simply pointing out that limitation. And are you arguing in favor of the more invasive test, which people may then decline, or are you just making an observation?
I'm just making an observation. I mean, because I'm thinking of this would mainly affect males. There's no way a male will say, go ahead and take a swab of the urethra. If I'm going to have to pee in a cup or I'm going to take a swab, I'll pee in a cup every time.
Right.
So that's where you're going to lose, unfortunately, a lot of folks. Unless they are one of your frequent flyers,
and then the second comment was, and
which
I'll entertain as soon as I get the second comment into the record. Are you able to repeat the second comment which spoke to you, Ben, or no?
No, I'm sorry. I was paying attention to what the response was.
Can you repeat what your second comment was really quickly, just in summary? It'll cue my memory.
He said that the test folks, everyone versus folks that just are symptomatic and get treated.
Yes. So
that's actually a pretty common phenomenon.
Thank you, Ben. Yes. So the second comment was that it may be problematic that when we know what the presenting condition is, that we don't test, because in not testing, we may miss the information about whether this is a reinfection or whether this is a naive infection.
Well, then it's also saving your facility money.
Right.
Right. Yes, the reason we do it is because it does save money. And yes, please, your question. And why don't you come to the mic? Why don't you come to the mic to ask it so that, again, it gets recorded? Well, that's it.
My question is, you mentioned that sometimes people hesitate to do like urethral, a swab or something like that. But what we see as a documentation in their patient's record is like three or four sources for the chlamydia and gonorrhea. For example, the oral the nasopharyngeal source, the urethral for men, vaginal, cervical. So you mean that those documents are not like very precious? If people are just hesitating to do that and they just record it as a like, you know, that every time that you are recording the record, at the bottom of the table, right, is from three sources. But as you told us, it means that some people just don't want to do that, like a urethral sources or something like that. It means that it's not precious that we are just collecting those data. Because I'm working as a MMP person for HIV STD, and we always just collecting those data from the patient's record. And I wanted to make sure that what happened there in the laboratory. My question is that you told us that they always we have some patients that prepare to go through the, for example, urine as a urethral swab, but I always saw that at the bottom of the table for gonorrhea and chlamydia, they documented that infections get tested from the urethral and urine for men. And and pharyngeal and cervical and vaginal for women. So it's always documented like that, and we should document it the source of the infection.
Well, the tests are typically only, they're FDA approved for urine and swab. Anywhere else, extragenital, and the lab will do it for you. That means they have validated. And it's an off-label test because there's not as many, most of the tests are typically done either from a swab or from urine. And so FDA has only got approved for those pretty much those two sources. But laboratories, if they get enough of a clientele, will go ahead and validate the test and then can
you. Thank you.
Yes.
And I just have one comment, and thank you for mentioning the HIV outbreak in Indiana. Your data was a little bit old, so there are 181 cases, 92% of which are infected with vaccine.
Thank you. So that was an update of data. There are now 182 cases, 81 cases of HIV in Marion County or in... In Scott's County.
Yeah, I gave an example to show that HIV and HCV are more.
Yes, the outbreak that happened there. And you updated it with 181 cases and 92% are co-infected. Yes, thank you. Other questions or comments? Any last comments from the panelists? Well, on that note, thank you very much for attending.